I come to a quantum matter seminar. So it's a pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Linnea Grant Samuelson. She's joining us from Second Life, France, and she's currently a PhD student there working on conformal field theory and non-conformal field theory and mathematical aspect of it. So today we will hear about discretizing 2D conformal field theories. Okay, Linnea, go ahead.
Hey, thank you, and thanks a lot for inviting me. So the plan for the talk will be that I will first give some general background and motivation, in particular about conformal field theory. And I will then introduce this discretized conformal algebra that is the focus of the talk. I will discuss what I've been using it for mostly, which is applications to non-unitary conformal field theories. Then I will discuss some results about convergence that I have found, and finally some results in particular models of interest, so the loop model and the six vertex model in particular. And there are some references here on archive that you can look up if you want to. So, conformal field theories, by definition, are field theories that are invariant under conformal transformations, which would be any angle-preserving transformations. So in particular, they are scaling invariant. And as such, they are fixed points of the RG flow, which is one reason why we're interested in them. So typically, when we work with field theories, we try to expand them around some RG fixed points. For example, free field theories would be something we like to expand around. So CFTs play an important role in general if we want to understand conformal QFTs. They show up in string theory, they show up in ADS CFT, and the part that is of most interest to me is that they show up in critical systems, so at phase transitions, for example, liquid to gas or ferromagnetic to paramagnetic. So I will discuss this last point a bit more. Typical example is the Ising model, of course, and you can see that at very low temperature, you have a very boring, in a sense, behavior. Let's say that you have all spins aligned, or if the temperature goes to infinity, you also get just some noise, but precisely at the critical point, you get this very neat scale invariant behavior, where you can see that if you would zoom in or zoom out on this picture, you get the same type of picture. You would get these clusters. You can't really tell what's the length scale. And at such a point, instead of having an exponential decay of any correlation functions, you would get some power law. And the goal is to find the power of the power law, because the correlation functions are the observables that we want to compute. So an example would be, for example, spin-spin. Then you would find the power law in terms of the conformal dimension of the spin operator. And if you are just in any general dimension, then there are four generators of the conformal groups. You would have translation, rotation, dilation, and the special conformal transformation. However, in two dimensions, the conformal algebra is infinite. So you have any holomorphic function giving you a conformal mapping. And here are just some examples. You could have mapping z to 1 over z, or z square. You have all the trigonometric functions, the exponential, all of these give a conformal mapping. So, and in this case, in this case, the conformal symmetry is really powerful. So we know, for example, just from complex analysis that we can use, let's say if we have the Laplace equation at some domain with a really terrible boundary, if we can map this boundary to, let's say, just a circle, then, well, we can solve the Laplace equation much more easily. And similarly, in conformal field theory, we use the conformal symmetry to compute correlation functions. Now, another really useful tool is lattice discretization of field theories, because they are mathematically well-defined and rigorous, and they're also very easy to put on a computer. So my question is, can we combine these tools? Can we combine conformal symmetry with lattice discretization? And let's be a bit more precise to be able to discuss this. So the symmetry algebra is the Virasoro algebra. So we start by looking at the infinitesimal coordinate transformations, which will give you the first part of the Virasoro algebra, the width algebra that you see here. and then you take the central extensions, you only have one option, so you get this central term here that depends on the central charge, C, that has several different interpretations. So physically, for instance, it's related to the degrees of freedom of the system. You can see that if you have several bosons, then C is the number of bosons you have. It also appears in the two-point function of the stress energy tensor, which I will come back to. And of course, here in the Virasoro relation. So concretely, asking if we can discretize two-dimensional conformal symmetry means, can we discretize the Virasoro algebra and have it act in lattice systems? Okay, so let's do this. So let's look at the lattice models that we will consider. And the idea is that we build these lattice models using the transfer matrix formalism. So we will build them row by row. So this operator here is the transfer matrix. And this one in turn is built out of local operators, the R matrix that looks like this plus here. And we will be interested in a class of lattice models where the R matrix is expressed in terms of an algebra called the Temporally-Lieb algebra. And then to select for a particular lattice model, you choose a particular representation of the Temporally-Lieb algebra. So more precisely, we say that the R matrix will be on the form of identity plus some constant times Ej, where Ej is the generator of the Temporally-Lieb algebra, so it fulfills these relations that E square equals to D, which we call the loop weight, times just E, Ej. And Ej plus minus 1 Ej just gives back Ej. And if we do this, the lattice model will be integrable. Now, as a diagram algebra, you can see the Temporally-Lieb algebra as a way to connect two rows of dots. And the generator is just this cup and a cap here, while on all other sides, you just connect the dots as a line. And then the rules are that multiplication is just stacking diagrams vertically. You see that the loop weight shows up here as D, and that the second relation is just that you can straighten a line. So I said that choosing models means choosing representations. So the most natural one is the loop model. So these models are interesting when we consider, for example, boundaries of clusters. So let's say we do an expansion of the Ising model, or let's say the Potts model, then you get these boundaries around the clusters. And in this case, the states are really half diagrams. You can think of this lower row here, and then you act literally by stacking diagrams on top of them. And you will build the lattice configurations row by row. So you can think of the identity, we just squish the lines to make it correspond to the figure, and then by this cup and a cap. And by varying the loop weight, we obtain a whole family of continuum limit CFDs with different central charges less than one. Another, and perhaps less intuitive representation, is in terms of spins. So this comes if you consider the six vertex model, which shows up if you want to, historically it shows up if you try to understand residual entropy in ice. So you have this very simple model of ice where you place oxygen on a lattice and you say that hydrogen is close to, well, two of them are close to each oxygen, which you represent by an arrow saying which one it's close to. And then if you put different weights, if you generalize this by putting different weights on each possible vertex, you get the six vertex model. And in this case, you see that you have spin variables on the edges. So in this case, the state will be just a spin state. And the Temporally-Lieb generator will be a particular combination of Pauli matrices that will fulfill the Temporally-Lieb relations. So it's definitely less intuitive. And then again, with different choices of the weights, we can get a whole family of continuum limit CFDs, and again with the charge less than or equal to one. All right. Now, what we will do in practice is we will rephrase these two-dimensional Euclidean lattice models as one plus one-dimensional quantum spin chains. So 2D is very natural in order to think of conformal transformations, but to think of states and operators, we prefer the spin chain. And in this case,
So you mentioned this construction can give rise to all the minimum models in 2D CFT?
Yes, you can get the minimum models. They would correspond to these RSOS models here. So it's another version where you get, instead of a spin chain, you get an anion chain.
And
that's yet another representation of the Temporally-Lieb algebra.
Does this algebra also give constructions of other 2D CFTs?
Yes. So the CFTs that we will look at in particular are non-unitary and sometimes logarithmic. So it will not just be the minimal models, but you can also get some more complicated examples.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Right. So that covers the second example, the RSS model. This one will just have this perhaps too familiar Hamiltonian where you use some F moves, you look at the fusion channel between some anions, let's say we look at a golden chain. And in this case, EI would really be just assigning an energy gain for having the identity here. But for the six vertex model, we would, for example, get the familiar Heisenberg spin chain. So as I said, there are some particular combinations of polymatrices that would yield the representation of the Temporally algebra. And all of these models will, of course, be on a critical point because we want to consider a continuum limit described by conformal field theory. Furthermore, we will, in this talk, consider periodic boundary conditions. So we consider the bulk CFT where we have two copies of the Virasoro algebra. And the goal is then that we want to find some discrete Ln, these Virasoro generators, as a function of Ej, the Temporally generators, acting in the spin chain. And to do this, we will consider the stress energy tensor. So in any dimension, the local stress energy tensor is the conserved current that would correspond to the conformal symmetry. And in particular, in two dimensions, we can see that we have two components of interest, the ZZ component and the Z bar component. And the Virasoro generators will appear as modes if we expand these components. So in the cylinder, we will take Fourier modes and you simply get Ln through this. So in order to define discrete Ln, we look for a discrete version of the stress energy tensor, and then we just take the modes of it. How do we do this? Well, this is a construction that builds on work done already in the 70s, but which was really done in the 90s by Kuh and Seller. And the idea is to consider ward identities. So in a conformal field theory, we know that if we're straining the system and consider the effect of that on correlation function, this is really like inserting this integral of the stress energy tensor. And we want to find the lattice equivalent of this. So if we consider, for instance, the Ising model, and let's say with different couplings in X and Y direction, then we really look for a lattice operator that plays the same role. So we want to strain the system, which is just taking these derivatives, and see what operator would give this effect. So let's do that. So we want to work a bit with these derivatives in blue. And now the idea is that at a critical point, any large distance behavior of the correlation function will only depend on the weighted distance, where S is a function of the different coupling constants. So you can see it as depending on this angle. So if instead of a square lattice, you would really stretch the lattice to correspond to the coupling strength, then S is related to this angle here, where the angle is in turn related to these kx and ky, the coupling strength. So this derivative here that we want to change, that we want to re-express, it will give derivatives in terms of these coupling constants. Just going through that, okay, this gives derivatives in terms of S, in terms of theta, in terms of K. And you can see that this in turn would just give you some combination of delta functions, which in general will not be very nice. But in the Hamiltonian limit, which we're interested in, these derivatives will just give some nice expressions in terms of Temporally algebra. And this is fairly natural. You can recall that the interactions are governed by the Temporally algebra. So if we start taking derivatives with respect to the coupling strength, then it comes out. And luckily for us, the resulting operator we find is the sum of local operators. So if you recall the CFT identity, you had some integral over something that we say is TXX. So now we get the sum, and of course we will call the summand TXX. And we will say that this is the lattice version. And similarly, we will look for TXY going through the whole program again. So the result will be that TXX is given in terms of just the Temporally generators. Meanwhile, TXY is given in terms of commutators of the Temporally generators. And for a spin chain with a temporarily Hamiltonian, we see that this really corresponds to just the energy density for the first of them. And the second will correspond to the lattice momentum density. So we will really get the stress energy tensor as just energy density plus or minus lattice momentum density. And this was the starting point for another group with Milstead and Vidal, where they wanted to make this construction without relying on integrability. So finally, with this stress energy tensor, we just take the modes, and this defines the Cope Celluloid generators. And here you need to insert the central charge if you want to define L0. And you relate it to the loop weight, so we will parameterize both of them. So central charge is given by 1 minus 6 over xx plus 1, while the loop weight is given in terms of gamma being pi over x plus 1. And then for the fields in the conformal field theory correspond to what we call scaling states on the lattice. And we will need to take a double limits procedure for this construction, which I will come back to.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
Just want to make sure. So in your previous slides, you mentioned these relations are obtained within a specific model where you have two coupling constants, Kx and Ky. And yes. Later you said it can also go beyond integrability. So just want to make sure of this. It doesn't rely on some particular model, or does it?
No, so I know that the goal, at least of Milstead and Vidal, was to not rely too much on integrability. But I think for them, they just said that, okay, if we take energy density plus minus lattice momentum density, then and then they just check numerically that this works out. It seems to work. I'm not sure how solid this construction is, because to me, there are real connections between the structure of an integrable model and a conformal field theory. But if you want to look at what they did, you have the archive reference here.
Yeah, thanks. Also want to make sure, what do you mean by lattice momentum?
Right. So that's what, in this context, it's not exactly what you get if you act with the translation operator, but it's rather what you would get if you consider a two vector of energy and momentum. So in four dimensions, this would be the usual four vector, and you want to have energy momentum conservation. So you know, you take the time derivative of the energy, you take the derivative, the space derivative of the momentum. Then you can see that in order to have this energy momentum conservation, this is the construction you need to make.
I see. Actually, it's defined such that the energy momentum conservation holds.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. So this defines the Cope Celluloid generators. If there are any more questions up until this point, now it's a good time before I move to applications. All right. So what have I been doing with these? Why do we like them? Well, I've been using them in non-unitary conformal field theories. So I should start by saying why we care about non-unitary conformal field theories, which for someone from, let's say, particle physics perspective might sound a bit strange, but from a statistical mechanics perspective, it makes a lot of sense. So let's say that we consider the loop model again. Then if we say that we have a Boltzmann weight d per loop, this is really a non-local formulation, because a loop is an inherently non-local object. And similarly, if we compute correlation functions, for example, the probability that two points are on the same loop, this is also a very non-local problem. So we want to rephrase the problem in terms of local Boltzmann weights. Now, if we do this, and it's easiest to see on the honeycomb lattice, then what we do is we assign a weight for each right or left turn. And we know that for any loop, the number of left turns minus right turns will be 0 modulo 6. And then we just sum over both orientations, and we see that we get the loop weight d as 2 cosine 6b, where v is this v in the local weight. But we see that the Boltzmann weights that are local are also complex. So this is now a non-unitary theory. Now, in terms of the Virasoro representation theory, then everything becomes a lot more complicated. So what we normally have is just some general features, is that L0 will play the role of the Hamiltonian, or L0 plus L0 bar. And we sort our state space into some highest weight representations, which would be just lowest energy. And then we have the raising and lowering operators, Ln, and just some terminologies that this lowest energy state here is called primary, and the others are called descendants. And now some complications that can happen is that sometimes we're not able to identify the highest weight state only by the weights. So for instance, the identity has a conformal weight h equal to h bar equal to zero. And it's distinguished by the fact that it's annihilated by L minus one, which always acts as a derivative, since of course the derivative of identity gives zero. And this gives a differential equation for any correlator that involves the vacuum. However, in non-unitary theory, you might have another state that also has h equal to h bar equal to zero, but that is not annihilated by L minus one. So we don't have the same differential equation anymore. And they represent these by diagrams. So this diagram here with the crossed out arrow would be really the identity state, while this diagram to the right is the other alternative. And of course, this is a fairly trivial statement that you get the differential equation for something involving the vacuum. But in general, in conformal field theory, you have certain weights, certain degenerate weights, where you get these type of differential equations for states at some level. So let's say that at level two is that you again have L minus one here squares, so you will get some second order differential equation. And so in general, we need to check in non-unitary CFT if any of these differential equations hold. Or in other words, we have to check if null states are really zero. Now, the second complication is that in non-unitary CFT, we sometimes are unable to fully diagonalize L0 in the first place. So at most, we can put it in Jordan normal form, and then we will get Jordan blocks with some fields that will mix under the action of L0. So in the case where L0 is diagonalizable, this is the case where we get the typical correlation functions that are just power laws. While if it is not, so it has this form here, where we see that L0 can take us from V1 to V2, then the correlation functions will obtain some logarithmic corrections. So when we want to compute correlation functions, this is of course also really important to know if this can happen. So what we can do is we can use the Kussler generators directly on the lattice to distinguish between states in complication one by just acting literally on the states, or to find out if L0 mixes states as in complication two. So the idea is, first of all, that we need to identify eigenstates on the lattice that would correspond to the states we want to investigate, some specific primary or descendant states. And this is easy, because we see that if we consider L0, then we get rid of the phase, and we really just have energy plus or minus momentum. So the conformal weights are directly related to energy and lattice momentum. And then we act, once we have identified the states, with these Kussler generators, and we project on some other state of interest. So we form these matrix elements here. So for example, if the first one here has weights 0, 0, and we act with L minus 1, and we project on some level 1 state, we can see if the state was really the vacuum or not. And we need to do this at larger and larger size, and then extrapolate the results in order to see what's the result in a continuum theory. So to do this, since we have an integrable model, we use the Bethe sets and quantum inverse scattering method. However, before we can do this, we need to see if the Kussler generators actually converge to the Virasoro generators, and in what sense. So this is the next part of the talk. As system size goes to infinity, will the Kussler generator go to the Virasoro generators? Well, first of all, we're always looking at matrix elements of the Kussler generators. So at most, we're looking at weak convergence. However, it's not clear that we should have that. So we have some artifacts of the lattice discretization that we need to take into account. We know that for any system at the finite size, we cannot accommodate arbitrarily high lattice momenta. So it's clear that all the states in a continuum theory cannot be represented on the lattice. And vice versa, there will be high energy states on the lattice that have no correspondence in the continuum theory, and we do not want to include those. So what we really want to do is that for any given system size, we want to restrict to low energy states by putting some cutoff. And then we are only allowed to raise that cutoff after taking the system size to infinity. So this is a double limit procedure that we call the scaling limit. So let's see how this plays out. Let's say that we want to measure the central charge, which we know is appearing in the tensor, the stress energy tensor correlation function with itself. So this means in practice that we want to compute the matrix element of L minus 2 followed by L2, because this is giving you the stress energy tensor. And we find the state that corresponds to the vacuum through the previous procedure. And this state is fine, it's a scaling state, it's a low energy state. However, if we resolve the identity here, we see that we get all the states appearing in the middle of this product, including these high energy states that have nothing to do with the continuum theory. And it is known that matrix elements of a single Kuznets generators will converge to the continuum result. So each of the unwanted terms will converge to zero, but the number of such terms will grow rapidly. And the final disturbance due to these lattice artifacts is finite. So what we need to do is to put this cutoff on what states we project on, and then set it to infinity only after the system size goes to infinity. So this is a comparison between not having a cutoff and having a cutoff. So here we measure the central charge, again parameterized by x. And on this right-hand side plot, we just divide through with the proper value to make it a bit more clear what is going on. So you can see here that these points here are at lower size, then higher and higher, and then we extrapolate the result. The result that is marked by dots is when we use a cutoff, and we see that it falls exactly on the expected central charge. However, if we do not use cutoff, then in general, we do not get the correct value.
Excuse me?
Yeah?
So do you do the this comparison only for the unitary CFT?
No, it's for non-unitary CFT in general, but also for unitary.
So non-unitary CFT also has Virasoro algebra?
Sorry?
Non-unitary CFT also has Virasoro algebra?
Yes, it does.
I see, thanks.
Yeah, so in particular, in this case, I'm looking at the six vertex models and the loop models as examples of non-unitary CFT, while I'm looking at the unitary RSS models. So RSS models can be either unitary or non-unitary, but I'm looking at the unitary ones. And actually, a very interesting feature here is that we get the exact same matrix elements for all these three different models. So not only is the final result the same, but each of these finite size results is exactly the same for these three models, which is rather strange if you think about it, because the Hilbert space is of a different size. So you would expect that since you have a different number of finite states that you could couple to, then the disturbance towards the correct convergence shouldn't be the same, but apparently it is, which is not completely understood. It's something I would like to understand better. And there was also a modified version of the Kusala generators proposed recently by people at Station Q. And we see that the final result is again the same. So they have a slightly quicker convergence, but the extrapolation is the same.
Sorry, question? Just want to make sure. So for this type of non-unitary CFT, the central charge is still real and positive?
It can be negative, and in particular, it can be zero without the theory being trivial. So that's one case where you really need to consider non-unitary conformal field theories. If you have, for instance, percolation, we know that it should be described by a C equal to zero CFT, but we also know that it's non-trivial. So it has to be non-unitary. And the same, it shows up in the quantum Hall effect. In that case, you would get the non-unitarity from averaging over disorder. And again, you know that you should have some C equal to zero CFT, and again, it's clearly not trivial, so it has to be non-unitary.
Yeah, that's where my confusion is, because looking at this expression of, you know, L minus 2, L2 expectation, that shouldn't that always be positive, at least?
No. So in this case, the conjugate of Ln is not the same as L minus L.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, if it's a non-unitary theory. It's exactly how the non-unitarity shows up. Of course, if it's unitary, you always have L and dag is equal to L minus N, but not if it's non-unitary.
Okay, all right, thanks.
Yeah, right.
So how is the cutoff chosen?
So the cutoff, in practice, what we do is we consider several cutoffs and we just make sure that it converges to the same result. Because the idea is that as long as you make the extrapolation in size first, you can have as big of a cutoff as you want. As long as it's a fixed finite cutoff, you could have 10,000. Of course, in practice, we don't do that. We do make 5, 10, 15. but really, as long as you keep it fixed, it doesn't matter. What you need to do is you need to include all the states that would play into your theory. So in this case, you need to include all the level 2 states. Otherwise, you will not get the correct result because you don't project on all the states that you should project on.
When you project out some state that are not in the continuum limit, so does that include like state that includes dislocation like that?
So in my case, I really sort the states just by diagonalizing the Hamiltonian. So this gives a very clear picture, especially in the terms of the Bethe ansatz. You can really sort the states by just looking at the pattern of the Bethe integers. So I really just do it in terms of eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, and I say that, okay, this energy and below is fine.
Uh-huh.
Or in terms of Bethe integers, we say that we are only allowed to make modifications to the edge of the Bethe integer configuration.
So eigenvalue is your criterion, is that?
Yes, that's the simplest one to use. Or in terms of Bethe integers, you just look at the configuration. But yes, eigenvalue of the Hamiltonian is really what we do in practice.
So you want the eigenvalue to be finite in the limit that lattice spacing goes to zero, is that what it is?
We want to have, let's say, the first n number of eigenstates sorted in terms of eigenvalue. So we fix the number of eigenstates we consider.
But is there a qualitative difference between the state that you keep and the state that you throw away?
Yes, there is in terms of the Bethe integers. So perhaps I can show you this at the end of the talk, that you can really sort what kinds of excitations you can do. So in terms of Coulomb-Gauss formalism, it would correspond to all the electric and magnetic excitations you can do to your states. But let's say you have a row of Bethe integers, you're not allowed to make holes in the middle, for instance, if you know this formalism.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Okay. There we go. Right, so this double limit procedure, it means that we don't even quite have weak convergence. We have what we call scaling weak convergence. But there is an interesting part of this story, which is that even if we don't use the cutoff, the result is almost right. And this is very useful for purposes of, let's say we are in a framework where it's hard to implement these projectors onto low energy states, then we know how to compensate for it. So what happens is, instead of having the usual Virasoro relation, where you have the central term appearing in this form here, we find that if we don't use the cutoff, we only modify the cubic part of the central term by adding some C star that has a really terrible expression. So you can find this by computing the exact expectation values of different combinations of Templer-Leib operators in the thermodynamic Bethe ansatz. And we see that at a few points, at x equal to 1, 2, and 3, we get C equal to C star. So then we really don't need to use cutoffs. Everything works fine. So let's say at C equal to minus 2 or 0 or 1 half, everything is fine. And meanwhile, if we don't use cutoff in general, we just follow this curve here. But we know exactly how to take it into account because we know C star. So this to me was also somewhat surprising because you could imagine that with no cutoff, nothing should work because there are all these high energy states that you couple to. Right. So now we have the convergence under control. And in practice, we would always use the cutoff, of course, because we want to get the expected results. So let's get back to these models that I was mentioning. So they are both non-unitary, and we will see that the non-unitarity shows up in different ways. So if we consider the first complication that I mentioned, the fact that you cannot identify the states only by the conformal weights, then what we do is we start acting with the Kusala generator L minus one on some state. We form this matrix element here, and we extrapolate the result, which is shown here in this plot. So either this matrix element goes to zero, which is really this leftmost diagram that you expect if you have the vacuum, or it goes to another value that we also can conjecture, and that corresponds to this right diagram here. And we see that in the loop model, you only get the left diagram, while in the six vertex model, you get both. For any magnetization of the spin chain, you will get both of them appearing. So this means that these PPZ differential equations, you can go ahead and use them in the loop model just by knowing the conformal weights, while in the six vertex model, you need to make some extra checks. You cannot just rely on the conformal dimensions. Meanwhile, if we consider the second complication, it's the opposite case. So in this case, it shows up in the loop model. It will have these two rank two Jordan blocks, and we get these logarithmic corrections to the correlation function. So we see that this is the logarithmic conformal field theory. And it is a logarithmic CFT at generic values of the central charge. So this applies to the Owen model and Potts model, both of which can be formulated in terms of loops. And this was not known before, so it's a very interesting new result that these are LCFTs. And meanwhile, for the six vertex model, L0 is still diagonalizable. So everything is as usual with these typical power laws. And let me just mention that we can also use these results as an input in bootstrapping the Potts and Owen models. So we see that since we have these logarithmic representations of the Bidrisor algebra, we also have to use logarithmic conformal blocks in the crossing symmetry equation. So I just represent the blocks here by these diagrams, and we need to use logarithmic blocks. So what we have done is we have actually bootstrapped a non-unitary CFT, which is very interesting because usually bootstrap relies on unitarity. I won't really have time to talk about this, but if you want to ask me more about it, perhaps tomorrow, then feel free. Right, so to summarize, we have defined these Kusala generators, which are discrete versions of the Virasoro generators written in terms of the Templi-Leap generators. And we have seen that we can apply them to non-unitary conformal field theory to deal with the complicated representation theory. We have defined scaling weak convergence in terms of double limit procedure, but we have also seen that even if we want to not use projectors, we know how to take the effect into account. And finally, we see that in two non-unitary models, the loop model and the six vertex model, the non-unitarity shows up in different ways. So in the loop model, we find Jordan blocks for L0, while in the six vertex model, we find states that have weights zero that are not the vacuum state, and same for the other degenerate states. Now, some future directions would be that so far, we have only considered irrational values of central charge because it's easier. So a natural first thing to do is to extend the work to rational values of C, and in particular, central charge equal to zero, since this is important for models of physical interest, for example, percolation. So then we get these much more complicated Virasoro modules, and we can again use the Kusala generators to walk around and to really map out what the modules look like. And then we can consider RSS models more, which are of interest because they correspond to anion chains. So this is something we're currently doing. We can use this to build a lattice version of topological defects as well and to identify them. So a very simple example is there's a topological defect called a hoop operator that in terms of an anion chain would really just look like this hoop. And this one we can see already on the lattice because Y is in the center of the Templi-Leap algebra. So we know that it commutes with all these Kusala generators. And that means it commutes with the Virasoro generators, which means in turn that it can be pulled across the stress energy tensor, since that one is just summing up the Virasoro generators. However, this only gives you some of the topological defects you should find in this model, the so-called S-type defects. And there is also a proposal for R-type defects that we don't expect to see already on the lattice. So we don't expect this commutation to be zero on the lattice. So in this case, we would really want to do the same thing, but just go into larger and larger size and then see if it's zero in the continuum. And then we can try to understand better this convergence and the appearance of this modification to the central term. And that is it for me. So if you have any questions.
Okay, thank you. Other question?
So the models you studied are all integrable, are they?
Yes, for me, I'm focusing on integrable models. So I would,
Is it okay to like straightforwardly apply those methods to non-integrable models?
I think it should be. As I mentioned, there's this work by Vidal and Milstead. So I think as long as you can build a local energy density and the local lattice momentum density, the way I described, by using energy momentum conservation, I believe you should be allowed to build a local stress energy tensor using these. In that case, of course, we would be more numerically restricted since we can't use the Bethan sets. But on the other side, we could use, for example, tensor network methods, which is also something I'm interested in extending this work to.
I see. And another question I have is, let's say if we consider higher dimensional septies, where we still have like energy momentum tensor and you still have ordered identities, is it possible to get its lattice version of the energy momentum tensor?
Right. You should be able, I assume, to get something like this, but you wouldn't get anything like Virasoro algebra. The Virasoro algebra is really just for two dimensions. Yeah. So this whole construction is a very two-dimensional thing.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, maybe I'll ask a question. So usually a conserved current, including the energy momentum tensor, is not unique in a theory. It's subject to ambiguities. Sometimes it's called improvement transformations in the continuum. So I'm asking, how do you see those in the lattice?
Linear, we are not hearing you.
Sorry. I hit the mute button. Yes, I was saying that in the lattice, we can see that the construction of the Virasoro, the Kusilau generators, it's actually not unique. So we have these higher Hamiltonians that involve more and more commutators of the Templi-Leib generators, for example, triple commutators, quadruple commutators, and so on. And you could also use these, you could use any combination. So it's really not a unique construction. This is just the simplest construction, and we expect that if we make some other construction involving these higher Hamiltonians, it wouldn't really add anything. It would just be more complicated.
But is there some way of characterizing the ambiguity in the lattice?
Sorry?
I mean, in the continuum, there is a, we know how to parameterize the ambiguity. One way is just by you couple to a background field, and then you write the most general minimal coupling to the background field, and that defines the kind of the improvement that you can make. So I mean, I'm saying that exactly these words should have an analog in the lattice.
Yeah, this I'm not sure what the analog would be. This one I'm not sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe related to Jiawen's question. So you mentioned to get all the other choices of Hamiltonians, or sorry, the algebra, you use the commutators of the temporally algebra. If the Hamiltonian is not integrable, so I still know what the Hamiltonian means. In that case, do you have some analog of that on the lattice?
I imagine that you could still get the same, but using that energy density instead. But I'm not sure. I haven't looked at it.
Okay, thanks.
So I have a live question. So about your the very first part. So it's the idea that you want to realize discrete version of local translation or conformal transformation by adjusting the way each side is connected to with the other side by adjusting the coupling. Is that the idea?
Yes, that's the general philosophy of looking at these local word identities, that changing the metric in a lattice model corresponds to changing the coupling constant. So that's why you get these derivatives with respect to the coupling constants.
Okay, yeah. So then this includes, in principle, not just conformal, but general diffeomorphism. Is that right? Can you find the lattice version of the generator of basically momentum density?
What we do find is, since we find the Virasoro algebra, you essentially have all the Witt algebra, just a centrally extended version. But you only get the infinitesimal version of the transformations, right? You don't actually get the conformal transformation because we don't know how to exponentiate it.
Oh, I see. So you cannot make it into finite transformation?
Yeah, at least I don't know what that would look like. It would be very interesting to do it, to really look at the lattice and be able to make a finite transformation. But all we have is really the Virasoro generators, so it's really just the infinitesimal one.
But what happens if you just exponentiate it? What kind of finite transformation do you get?
Yeah, it's not something we have considered, since we have mostly just focused on mapping out the representations.
Mm-hmm.
But it would definitely be interesting to look at.
And perhaps you can also gauge it. Have you considered gauging your?
No. It's really, as I said, the focus has really been on the representation theory of the Virasoro algebra for us.
But it's a exact symmetry of your model, so you can. There's no obstruction in gauging it. Is there? Right?
I don't know. The conformal symmetry only shows up in the continuum, right? You can't have an exact conformal symmetry on the lattice.
But your lattice generator.
So the lattice generators, you mean the Templi-Leib algebra, it's really just what we build the model out of. Now, if you want a symmetry on the lattice, then what you have in the open case, which is not one I've considered, is you get the UQSL2 symmetry. However, in the closed case, you actually don't even get that one fully.
Okay. Any more question from people? Okay, so if not, let's thank Linnea for interesting talk, and thank you everyone, and we look forward to chatting more tomorrow, Linnea.
Yeah, I really look forward to it. Thanks a lot. See you tomorrow.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, bye.